Welcome to Endeavors. Kick it, boys. Good afternoon, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. We are also on the internet at cjsf.ca. We stream in podcast Endeavors and all your other favorite CJSF shows, and you can find us on TELUS HD channel 7014. We are broadcasting from atop Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University. I'll be with you to the top of the hour. I said afternoon, but pretty soon it's going to be dark when I do this show, so we may be the evening, and when it gets dark at like, you know, 2:30 in the afternoon. Anyway, speaking of light and dark and things that affect us, we have great guests on the show today. The first is environmental activist Severin Cullis Suzuki. She's part of a new talk, Beyond World, at the Chan Center in October, and she's taking part with Polaris-winning musician Tania Tagak, and they're talking about art, sustainability, climate change, indigenous issues, all those sorts of things. It's going to be a really, really fun and informative night. And our second guest is local actor and director Chad Rook. He appears as the villain in the pilot episode of the new superhero series The Flash. So he talks to us about that and his love for playing villains and also professional wrestling, strangely enough. And he also is currently going into production on a feature as his directorial debut, which he also co-wrote and stars in. And we're going to be hearing music from the great punk band Orwells, and music off of their new album, Disgraceland. That's how we'll start today's show. This is a song off of Disgraceland. This is North Ave.
To
And that was North Ave by the Orwells off their album Disgraceland. Maybe you can play that song next time you're driving past Loheed Mall. I know it's North Road, but little creative licensing never hurt anybody. Okay, so I mentioned her at the top of the show. My first guest is a long-time environmental activist, Severin Cullis Suzuki. She's a speaker, television host, and author. She first became famous at the age of 12 when she raised money with members of the ECO to attend the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. And it was given over 20 years ago, but you know, very recently in the last, you know, in the internet age, her speech has become viral, called "The Girl Who Silenced the World for 5 Minutes." In 1993, she was honored in the United Nations Environment Program's Global 500 Roll of Honor. In also that year, Doubleday published her book, Tell the World, a 32-page book of environmental steps for families. She graduated from Yale University in 2002 with a BS in Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, and she's co-hosted Suzuki's Nature Quest, a kids television series on Discovery Kids. Also in 2002, she helped launch a think tank called Skyfish Project, excuse me, and was a member of former UN Secretary General's Kofi Annan Special Advisory Panel, and pledged the recognition of responsibility to the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg. She was the main character in the documentary film Severin, the Voice of Our Children, which was released in 2010. She is, of course, the daughter of legendary Canadian environmental activist David Suzuki. She'll be speaking on October 16th and 17th at the Chan Center for Performing Arts with Polaris-winning musician Tania Tagak as part of the Chan Center's Beyond World series, which brings together artists and activists for a discussion about, you know, literature, the arts, sustainability, and indigenous culture, stuff like that. She is Severin Cullis Suzuki, and I spoke to her earlier today from the Haida Gwaii. On the phone with me now is a longtime environmental activist, Severin Cullis Suzuki. Severin, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So you're part of a really interesting new initiative called Beyond Words, and you're doing it with Tania Tagak next month. How did you come to be part of this event?
Well, it's the Chan Center at UBC that does this speaking series called Beyond Words, and they've done it just for the last few years, where they've partnered musicians, writers, just trying to get some kind of interdisciplinary presentation and reflection. And so they invited Tania and I to collaborate, and actually I've never face-to-face met Tania. I've just been a fan of her work for a long time, and so it was a wonderful opportunity.
And I know with this one, a lot of the dialogue is going to be talking about the mass extinction that is set to already take place, and I've been hearing lots about, you know, how humans are going to be, you know, the next mass extinction. But what are some of the things and the factors that we're seeing that has set this extinction in motion already?
Well, that's one of the things that I want to talk about, the fact that we are currently undergoing or living through the Earth's sixth mass extinction event. This is something we just don't really talk about, but I mean, I was in Vancouver last week, and on the front page of the Globe and Mail, there was an article about scientists finding that by the end of this century, 50% of the birds may be extinct. We're living through the time, everybody knows about the last mass extinction, that was 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs went extinct. We're living through that scale of extinctions right now. And it's pretty serious business because, you know, humans are at the top of the food chain. That makes us vulnerable to the rest of the supporting ecosystems and species that support us. But not something we talk about.
What are, in your mind, what are some of the things we can do to either reverse the extinction or at least slow it down if possible?
Well, one major major component of any mass extinction is climate change. So climate change has happened many, many times in the Earth's history, and that definitely was a contributor for, you know, extinction events in the past. So we're currently undergoing extinction through climate change, and yet this time, this is different in history because our climate change is actually being caused by a species of creature, and that's us. So that's a pretty large component of trying to, you know, deal with slowing down the extinctions and slowing down climate change. Big issue today. The UN was meeting this week in New York to discuss this. Yeah, it's a pretty huge one. Also, loss of habitat is just a really major factor for loss of species all over the planet, and that's, you know, deforestation, use of natural resources in a way that, you know, isn't really taking into consideration ecosystem health, and those things, yeah, we have to stop.
I know on one of the things it says on here is our individual role in democracy, and you mentioned New York, which was the largest, I believe, the largest climate march in the world up until now. What does something like that achieve other than just people saying we're going to fight for this cause? How will that actually force people to who run the country to bring about change?
Well, governments are not the ones that initially lead any social movements. It's the people. It's the climate of the political climate and mood of the mainstream society for what issues are the most important for their political leaders to speak to. And we haven't really forced the question yet. There's many reasons why we haven't forced the political platform to respond to climate change. I mean, one is the huge lobby of climate denial that was very well funded by industry. But another is because it's such a huge problem. I mean, it's really hard to grasp. We have climate change that is basically a product of the modern lifestyle, that it's completely dependent on oil infrastructure, fossil fuel infrastructure that produces greenhouse gases. But how do you deal with that? I mean, everything we do depends on emitting greenhouse gases. It's very, very complicated. But these huge, massive public displays of unrest, basically, are extremely important to send a message, not only to politicians, but to people around the world, to raise consciousness that this is an issue of the people, that this growing awareness is changing. And with social media and the internet, human consciousness can change and shift and evolve, I think, much faster than it has in the past.
It could be argued that with Canada's current government, they've actually pushed our environmental movement backwards a little bit. What do you think needs to happen in Canada to bring about any real change?
Well, there's a very exciting movement happening, starting right now, and I'm on the board of the David Suzuki Foundation. It's a big honor to be on the board of the foundation that my parents started over 20 years ago, and we're just launching a campaign to amend the Constitution. So this is a pretty big project, a multi-year project, and it's being kicked off with the Blue Dot Tour, which is a cross-Canada tour. My dad, David Suzuki, and many different supporters and friends, performers, artists, musicians, are going to be holding events across the city. They just started on the 24th in St. John's, Newfoundland, and they're moving across the city, starting a conversation about what are our values around this pale blue dot in space, which is our home, planet Earth. Should be planet water, really, because we're mostly the world's oceans. But this is kicking off a conversation. You know, Canada's about to turn 150 years old. It's time to look at our values and look at who we are in the world and what kind of leadership we're taking with respect to the most pressing issue of our time, which is the fate of our ecosystems.
Now, here in Burnaby in Vancouver, we're engaged in a bit of a tiff with Kinder Morgan and, you know, the pipelines. And how does an issue like that, how does it affect climate change and kind of run in tandem with that? And why should we oppose the construction of any pipeline?
In 2009, in Copenhagen at the climate negotiations, the world agreed, I mean, countries, even conservative countries like Canada, agreed that we would limit the world warming to 2 degrees, which is what scientists say is the threshold for, like, dangerous climate change. If the Earth warms on an average of more than 2 degrees, life as we know it will fundamentally change and shift, and we will be, you know, it won't actually be within our power to slow down this, the shift of climate. So, you know, that's been a pretty clear benchmark in the last few years for what we have to limit. And so everybody agreed, yeah, we're going to limit. All the governments said, yes, sure. There wasn't exactly, you know, an outline pathway of how to get there. But now, even as we haven't really owned up to that, reduction in order to meet that target. Instead of making the massive cuts in greenhouse emissions that we have to do to stay within that 2 degrees, Canada is increasing its infrastructure for fossil fuel energies. So expanding Kinder Morgan is just one of those clear points where we really have to say, hey, wait a minute, what's happening? We're expanding our pipelines here when we actually have to be getting off of our addiction to oil. I mean, we're just continuing to build this infrastructure as if this is, you know, economic growth around the oil sands. The tar sands is, you know, the most important thing going, when actually, if we are going to continue to enjoy life as we know it, this has to rapidly and drastically reduce.
One of the things that I'm struck by, it says here, I'm just sort of reading the description of your talk coming up, and it's going to talk about the influence of women and indigenous ways of knowing. Those two sort of subsections of the human population, what is it about those two that you think will lead us into the future of this revolution?
Oh, well, that was very well said. This is an opportunity for myself to partner with Tanya Tagak, an Inuit modern throat singer and Inukpunk, self-declared Inukpunk. And this is an opportunity to talk about issues of Indigenous and non-Indigenous First Nations and settler, is another way of saying it, alliances and partnership, as well as the Aboriginal voice and the voice of women. Right now, we're in a in an economic growth paradigm. We're in a paradigm of extraction of resources and development as fast as we can, and it's a program and paradigm that really has not been balanced by a more, a feminine perspective of looking long-term for the future. I mean, this is, of course, a generalization, but by and large, you know, we've been led by this paradigm of taking and making quick profit. We've limited our looking at the future to such an incredible degree that now we look at quarterly reports in a year. We have lost our foresight that allowed human beings to survive to this point. And I would say, you know, this is something that is innate in, for example, motherhood. Myself, I just became a mother 5 years ago. And all of a sudden, my relationship to the future is fundamentally different. And I care about the future in a way I paid lip service to. But it's very, very profound. And we need to bring that spirit back to the human way of doing things, because that is how we have prevailed so far.
So, you know, it brings up the argument, you know, Hillary Clinton might be running for president again. And if more women were in charge, do you think there would be either a greater sensitivity to certain issues, I guess I would say?
I would hope so. I mean, for women to prevail and to be leaders, even approaching equal, having equal leadership, the whole system would really have to change itself. And so it's not just about, you know, just inserting women as leaders in the current, in our current governance structure or leadership structure or professional structures that we have. It's about the whole system structures changing to support family values, to support motherhood, to support these things that, you know, are undeniably female. And, you know, as a woman who is trying to both work and have children, it was very, very difficult. And I recognize now why there aren't more women in politics, why there aren't more women who are heads of large firms where you have to work crazy hours to get ahead. And that's a matter of biology.
You know, to bring it back to your talk, it seems like we're seeing a lot of artists, you know, actors, musicians, poets, that are really heavily involved in well, not just the environmental revolution, but just, you know, the gay rights movement, but just a lot of movements in general. I'm curious, do you see any parallels between the artists, people like Tanya and Leo DiCaprio, who's doing a lot of work, and the activists such as yourselves? Is there a sensitivity about being an artist that allows them to understand a lot of the issues that we're going through?
I think anyone who is sensitive to the world, reads the paper, you know, cares and has and thinks about things, I think will have some awareness and concern about the world. I fundamentally believe that people are good and they want to make a positive contribution to people around them, their families at the least, and then to the greater world. But it's very hard to see in this globalized world where we are hit by so much information every single day now. It's very, very hard to see where you could have an effect. It's very, very easy to be disempowered. I mean, myself, I feel disempowered often, and I am in a privileged position, you know. It's very, very challenging, and I think that these artists and movie stars, they're in positions of influence, and so they're trying to step up and take some responsibility because they can see that we need to start moving in a different direction if tragedies are going to be averted. We're already seeing tsunamis. We're seeing, well, not tsunamis. Those aren't caused by climate change per se, but we're already seeing hurricanes and monsoons and droughts and these awful events that are happening with increasing. We just see there's more and more of them, and it's very evident that change is here. And we have to try our best to do something about it.
What about the impact of youth? I mean, you became well known for a speech you delivered when you were 12. But how fundamental to any movement are the youth?
I believe that youth have a very essential role to play. Since Rio in 1992, when I gave a speech to the UN, it has gone all around the world, and people are still continuing to talk about it. It's definitely been my 15 minutes of fame. And it amazes me the longevity of the six-minute speech. I mean, it was recorded, unbeknownst to me at the time. It was recorded, captured by the UN, as all the speeches are. And then released, and then somehow eventually, after years later, when the internet was invented, it was uploaded. And the longevity, I think, is because of the power of youth. Youth can speak truth to power in such a profound way. And in this instance, in this issue, I think youth have the ultimate voice of authority, so to speak, in terms of who is going to pay for what we are doing today. I mean, today, over almost 50% of the world's population is under 35. It's, you know, the world does belong to the future, and yet what we are doing is completely robbing the future of options. We're going into times of massive climate change. and that is going to result in huge shifts, migrational shifts of humans, which is going to cause a lot of conflict as people are simply looking for food, for water. This is what we are handing the future generations. And on some level, we all know it. We know this. So I think just judging by the response that I've received for pretty much my whole life on the Rio speech, I see a real need for youth to play that role of speaking truth to power. And, you know, youth love calling adults on their hypocrisies, and they've got to do that. They've got to call for change. And they've, you know, I think it would be incredible if young people around the world rose up and said, you know, if you love us, things have to change.
Well, it is Beyond Worlds, and Severin will be in Vancouver at the Chan Center with Tanya Tagak on October 16th and 17th at 7:30 p.m. at the Telus Studio Theater. Severin Cullis Suzuki, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
All right, cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Severin Cullis Suzuki, and once again, she'll be speaking October 16th and 17th at the Chan Center Performing Arts with Tanya Tagak, who just recently won the Polaris Prize, and they'll be collaborating as part of the Chan's Beyond World series of conferences and events. Okay, we are going to have another song from the Orwells off their album Disgrace Land. This is the song Norman.
Way, way, way.
And that was the Orwells with Norman, off their album Disgraceland. And I had a chance to sit down with a few of the members of the Orwells, who are originally from Elmhurst, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. They just released their second album, Disgraceland, which I've been playing this past June. They have two singles on there, Who Needs You and Dirty Sheets. They have two other albums as well, Remember When, that was their first studio album, and that was August 2012. And then in 2013, they released two EPs, Other Voices, and of course, Who Needs You. But like I said, Disgraceland is their second full-length studio album. So I sat down with a few of them the other day to talk with them about Disgraceland, their writing process, and if they have any favorite memories from tour. So I'm here in the tour bus of the Orwells. Hello. How's it going, guys? So, you have a new album, Disgraceland. How did this album come about, and what was the process like for you guys putting it together?
We just kind of wrote it. Really simple as that. We had finished our last one, and it was time to start writing the next one. And it was just kind of, you know, what was happening in our lives at the time that we were writing about, or, you know, what, like, just experiment with two new kinds of ways to write songs and structures, and that's how the music came about. But really, just as simple as, you know, it's time to write the next one.
Would you say that your process is a pretty fluid process in terms of how you all collaborate ideas and put songs together?
Yeah.
It's not very scheduled.
It's fast moving too. It's like we write a song in like 3 hours and that's it. Don't like never really kind of just like sit on one for days trying to make it absolutely perfect. It's just kind of like, you know, it has to have the spontaneous flow.
So I got to ask about the name. It in any way inspired by Orwell or 1984?
No, we just dug the last name. It's really that simple too.
Disgraceland, sort of the opposite end of the spectrum from Elvis in terms of his Graceland album, or?
Right. I don't know. I mean, I guess we just thought it sounded cool, and we were like, you know, a lot of these songs are about where we're from, and that seemed like a good one-word representation of what, you know, the place we grew up was.
So, you know, you guys have been described as a punk band. Coming to a city like Vancouver, where it's so diverse, what do you make of sort of the music community here? I mean, I know you guys haven't had a whole lot of time to you know, take it all in, but sort of first impressions of the music community, the punk community here?
Well, the dudes we love being first are pretty cool. That's all I know, really. Like, there's not...
Yeah, it's our first time being here.
Yeah.
And we've literally rolled right up to here and then have spent the 2 seconds about here in that venue.
All right. Are there any local bands we should know of that you would like to...
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of really good ones. There's Five Alarm Funk, which are really sort of good, energetic, like kind of dance punk-ish. Colleen Renison has a really good band, and she does really good solo stuff, too. So those are two recommendations I would make. We were talking before the interview about sort of the area of town we were in and how we just saw a drug deal happen right outside this bus, most likely. Being a touring band, do you guys have any crazy stories of things that you've witnessed on the road?
It's always a hard one because it's not like there's a lot of stuff. It's that we've experienced. It's just more like, do we remember the night?
You see like your normal, probably what everybody else has kind of seen. The weirdest shit that everybody else has seen is probably the weirdest shit that we've also seen.
So just being on tour, how do you guys as a band keep it fresh every night, or is it at, you know, each new city, it's not the same show because the fans are different. So, the album, would you guys, each of you, would you say you have a favorite song off of Disgraceland?
I like North Ave a lot. I like Southern Comfort a lot. The Righteous One a lot. Yeah.
I mean, mine's best.
Probably The Righteous One. I like that one.
Yeah. Is there any sort of particular, is it the style, would you say? How it flows?
I think it's honestly just, we've been playing it so long, it's just, I like playing my part. Like, I actually physically like playing that bass line, so that's probably why it's my favorite. Maybe not because of the song, but just because, I mean, they're not even songs to us anymore, they're just, like, fragments of parts that we have to do, so it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to pick your band's favorite song.
Yeah. Being sort of in, you know, when I talk to punk and punk rock S bands, a lot of them talk, you know, in a lot of the bands you see politics play a big part in stuff they write about. For you guys, what makes a good song for you?
Melody. I mean, I think that's what anybody ever listens to a song for, is just good sounds, good to their ear, and they like melody.
And in terms of the lyrical content, is it just a matter of finding the right words to go with the melody, or do you guys actually try to write about stuff?
It's all in this kid's head.
Like, if I hear the song, it, like, has a certain vibe to it. Like, if, like, the music sounds creepy, then I like...
Yo, I have no idea how to get to the menu.
You seriously just walk out and go left.
Down
right there.
Yeah,
no,
down.
Left in that alley.
Left in that alley?
Yes.
Alright.
And, yeah, I don't know, it's like an eerie sounding song that I want to hear the lyrics. And I come up with, like, the first line. It's pretty easy to, like, go from there. And, unless I wrote the lyrics before, a lot of them turn out to just be about, like, made-up situations and, like, fiction. Or, like, almost like... I like going about it as, like, a short story sometimes, as opposed to, like, autobiographical type shit.
Would you say you have a set method for writing, or just kind of whatever comes to you, and you just get it out there?
Yeah, there's no set way I do it. It's just kind of it could be some. The lyrics could just be something I saved on my phone like 3 months ago. And then I look at it and it works for whatever the song sounds like.
Favorite memory of this tour so far, if you guys have one? Or just a moment that maybe stuck with you?
Seattle last night, that show was good. It was a good time on stage.
Seattle's a great city for a lot of good music.
Yeah, they like rock.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
I got to see D'Antler a couple times.
Oh, yeah? Good stuff.
For free.
Nice.
Seattle was probably fun. Seattle last night was cool.
Well, they're here, folks. This is the Orwells. Thanks, guys.
Absolutely. Thank you, man.
And that was the Orwells, and I spoke to them just outside of the Rickshaw Theater where they played on the weekend. My next guest is a local writer, actor, and director who has appeared in such TV series as Cedar Cove, Bates Motel, Cult, The Secret Circle, Alcatraz, Sanctuary, John Doe, and Supernatural. He will be appearing in the pilot of The Flash, playing Clyde Martin, and is just about to start production on The Perfect Pickup, his directorial debut, which he also co-wrote and directs, and he stars in as well. He is Chad Rook, and I spoke to him last week from Vancouver. Joining me on the phone now is a local actor, writer, director, Chad Rook. Chad, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot, Dan. I appreciate it.
So you got a few projects in the works. The one that I was connected to you with was you appear in the pilot of a new show, The Flash.
Yes.
Tell us about that experience.
I've been obviously a local actor for quite some time, but Flash is obviously one of the biggest projects. You know, I've been blessed with being cast, and basically I play Clyde Marlin, aka the Weather Wizard, which is one of the main villains that faces the Flash and basically the entire history of Flash. He's one of the rogues. He battles him, you know, continuously, and so now I get to portray him for the first time on television. So I'm pretty excited to, needless to say.
You know, given that there's such a large canon for this character and for the Flash characters already, did you approach the role differently than you would a character that was made up for in that script?
Yeah, well, it was a little bit different. I actually had about 7 auditions for the show. I actually was auditioned for the Flash himself and then for another character named Eddie Song. And then they asked me to read for Clyde Martin. And so basically my first 2 auditions for Flash and for Eddie Song were just kind of a normal audition because they were kind of more normal characters. And then when they asked me to read for Clyde, I kind of went extreme with it. And the character himself controls the weather. And so I went in there and said, okay, what's going to make this guy unique? And you watch different things and you watch different shows as to how other villains have been portrayed in the past. And not too many people know this, but to come with the character, I'm actually a wrestling fan, like a WWE fan. Okay. And one of the wrestlers actually on there, I know it's like a man soap opera, but one of the wrestlers actually is a guy named Bray Wyatt. And he's kind of this yokel preacher type thing, and he had some really cool movements and stuff that he does, and so I kind of fed off of that and came up with this guy who has kind of a god complex now that he can control the weather, and I used kind of those movements and came up with something pretty creative that looked as though the weather was kind of running through his body. And thank God, you know, David Nutter, the director, and Andrew Kreisberg, who in the room, they understood what I was doing, because it could have very fast gone a very bad way. So,
do you enjoy playing villains or darker characters?
Love it. I was raised with like horror films and stuff. I love them so much, and so I always kind of appeal to the bad guy. And I mean, you look at like all my past characters, I play a lot of villains, and so. If I had a choice between a villain and a good guy, I'd always 100% take the villain. I mean, they're the guys who get to shoot the coolest guns and drive the badass cars. I mean, they're definitely the character you want to play.
It seems that in a lot of works that villains are often the more complex characters.
Mm. Yeah, they're usually the ones who have a reason as to why they're doing the bad stuff. And it usually stems from, you know, a bad history of something. Whereas the good guy, a lot of times, I think they're doing good because people are doing bad, but you don't really understand why people are doing bad too much. So it always has the, you know, I think a deeper backstory to those characters, which makes them a lot more interesting and sinister in some way.
Flash is a one of a number of comic book inspired shows on the air. You've got Arrow, you've got Gotham coming up, and even shows like Hannibal. And I mean, superheroes have been around forever and we're seeing them in movies, but there's this sort of second resurgence of them that we're seeing on TV. What is it about that genre and that form of storytelling that has endeared fans for generations, do you think?
Well, I think it's the characters. I mean, I think the day of bubblegum shows is kind of over. I think people want to see new things. And the thing is that as technology evolves, we now have the ability to be able to take these type of characters and portray them on TV as opposed to just film. Marvel has really taken over the theatrical type thing. And so DC is now almost taken by storm, in mind the pun, television. And I mean, we have, like you were saying, I mean, we have Flash, we have Arrow, we have Gotham, Constantine, iZombie. I mean, they're really taking these comic book characters and comic book stories and taking them to TV, because now we have the technology to do it right. I mean, you look at, in the past, even Flash itself, in the early 90s, there was another Flash show, and it got canceled before the season even ended. Because, again, you have a special effects-driven universe, and if you don't have the ability to do it right, it's going to lose interest very quickly. And we now have the technology to do it, and it looks amazing. People are basically getting a feature film every week on television now, based on the technology that we have and the ability to do it.
Now, in addition to being an actor, I know you're also a writer and director, and you actually have a film coming out in a couple of months, The Perfect Pickup. How did this project start for you?
Yeah, it's actually not coming out. We're going into production of The Perfect Pickup.
Oh, okay.
So we haven't filmed it yet or anything. So basically, I, along with a good friend of mine, we own a production company called Checkmate Films, and we basically directed and wrote a lot of, like, music videos and short films and stuff. And so now we're going into production of a feature film called The Perfect Pickup. And when I first started acting, I was into comedy, and I always wanted to go back into comedy. So we picked up the pen and we started writing, and I wrote this film about four guys who try to find the perfect way to pick up women. And so now we're going into production, and we, you know, filmed a promotional trailer and we got interest, and that's the game plan for the rest of the year and going into early next.
As a writer, how, and as an actor too, how much do you draw on your own experiences when making a project?
Well, you have to, I think. I mean, you're going to run into a lot of roadblocks while writing, obviously, and I think driving from your own experiences is really the only way to go, other than, you know, doing your own research. But when you're writing something, you know, like The Perfect Way to Pick Up Women, where are you going to research? You have to kind of go to your friends, go to people that you know, and go to yourself as to, you know, maybe the failures and stuff in the dating world that you've kind of gone through. And then it just comes basically from, what do you think would be a ridiculous and funny situation? And that's where, you know, the writing part really kind of interests me, because then you just basically make up stuff and what you would like to see on TV. So
Now you're listed here as writer, director, and star. And I've heard a lot of differing opinions about whether you should direct yourself in a project. What is your take on that, and how do you plan to approach that?
Well, this is the first time that I've done that. I've directed before, but this will be the first time I've directed and starred. And the good thing, like I was saying before, is I run a production company with a good friend of mine who also directs, and he's also starring. And so this is kind of a two-way street where we're able to almost have two directors on set, and we always have a couple eyes with our DPs that we work with all the time, that basically have the same vision with us. So we kind of have a team of directors, so to speak, even though I'm the official director, you know, we all have kind of the same vision as to what we want to do. So I trust them when I'm in front of the camera to get the same scenes and stuff, as, you know, and the same look and feel of the movie that I would want if I was behind the camera. So, and I agree though, it's both avenues, you know, being a lead actor and being a director, those are huge full-time things that when you're on set, you really don't have much room to do any other things. So having that team behind you really, to me, is the only way I would be able to do it or want to do it. So
do you approach directing differently than you would approach acting?
No, I think it's all part of the creative process of getting what you envision. And I think it's the same way. I mean, if you're doing acting, I think, you know, obviously you have to be the character and know your role, like to sell it. And I think with directing as well is that, you know, you need to know the lighting and vision, like those aspects of it, to sell that character as well. So even though it's the technique of what you're doing is slightly different, it all ultimately comes down to selling that character.
This could arguably be described as a romantic comedy loosely, or, you know, a comedy. And it's a genre that's as old as time. As someone who, you know, was first interested in comedy, when you watch a film, what do you like? What works for you?
I think it's just something that, you know, when you're raised with certain films and stuff, that's what you want to see. And so with me, you know, it was horror and it was comedy and stuff. So that's what I like to do. I like to see sometimes, you know, slapstick type comedy, and that's kind of what I want to create. So anything that I like to see is what I want to do. And that's why I started writing and directing, is because when you start out acting, you're not always given the roles and stuff that you want. So basically doing what you want and writing what you want, you know, that's really the only way of you being happy on set, because you're doing something that you want to see. And when you see it to fruition, that's really the ultimately best payoff, when you actually see the end results.
Now, you've had the fortunate experience to be on probably Vancouver's biggest phenomenon ever, Supernatural.
Yes.
Which has one of the most, I think, insane fan bases I've ever come across. Being a part of something that massive, talk about that, and what does that do for you as an actor?
Being on set, you don't really get, like, when I first started acting, I did like theater, and you always get that automatic feedback with the audience. They're right there, that interaction. And when you go on to TV and stuff, you don't get any of that. So that's why where social media comes in fact. But with Supernatural, you know, I get to go to these like conventions and stuff, and basically then you see how big of a fan base Supernatural really has, and what kind of fan base they have. And it's insane. It's unlike any other fan base out there. And as an actor, it just really, really kind of drives you and makes you realize very quickly why it is you do what you do, because of the excitement and, you know, the energy and the impact that what we do actually has on people. And Supernatural fans are definitely a very good telltale as to how much TV actually impacts the world.
And what can you tell us about My Life as a Dead Girl?
It's a new film that we're doing. It's with myself and Cassie Sproul, and it's basically filmed in post-production now, so it should be coming out early next year. It's a film, it's kind of a suspense thriller about the prostitution ring, and about a young pimp, so to speak, who is myself, I play, who refuses to let girls out of the prostitution ring by basically addicting them to drugs and that whole underground world, and making it so that they can't leave. And it's a very dark and abusive film, but it kind of brings light to that kind of world. It was very exciting to be on set with Cassie Scribble, like I said before. And I'm really looking forward to that one.
How do you get into the mindset of a character like that? Do you go out and talk to the people that are in that industry? Do you read up about it?
Yeah, a lot of times you do. For example, like even with The Flash and stuff, you know, you want to read the comics, you want to talk to the fans and stuff, and say, hey, you know, what is this about and stuff. But when you're doing characters like a pimp or anything like that, I'm not what they call a method actor. You know, if I play in a cocaine addict, I'm not going to go do a binge on cocaine. But once you have to kind of just watch what's been done in the past. You have to go from documentaries and news articles and stuff. And it's a very good, you know, sign of what actually happens when you read, like, and watch documentaries and stuff. And I think it's a very good way of kind of interacting with the character without having it go to like a dangerous level.
Well, the pilot episode of The Flash, I believe, premieres on October the 7th.
Yes, absolutely.
On the CW at 8/7 Central. The Perfect Pickup will be out sometime in the future, and My Life as a Dead Girl will be out next year. Chad Rook, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks a lot, Dan. I really appreciate it, brother. Thank you.
Alrighty, cheers. Have a good one.
All the best.
And that was Chad Rook. And The Flash premieres October 7th on the CW. My thanks to Chad Rook, my thanks to the Orwells, and my thanks to Severin Cullis Suzuki. We are going to take you out with a song by the Orwells off their album Disgraceland. This is The Righteous One. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. And bye, everybody. Bye.